All right. So thank you very much for the kind invitation to be here. And I'm going to talk to you about dominant members of the plant microbiome and looking at seed-transmitted endophytes. But first of all, I need to highlight the Phytobiomes Journal, which is a new journal. It's open access. It's one that's coming out of the APS Society, and we're really excited to see the traction that this journal has got. It's got phenomenal downloads. The first two issues are out, and we're going to have another issue coming up within the next month. So we're really excited. Come and talk to me. I'm here all meeting. You'll recognise me because I'll be in this T-shirt all week, and we have a little booth that's over by the posters. As you go right to the very right edge of the room, you'll find us, and we're giving away T-shirts and coffee cups, so lots of reasons, and of course stickers. So do come and talk to me about publishing in Phytobiomes. Now, when we think about grasslands, they actually make up one of the largest and most widely distributed ecosystems of the world. We're all here for an agricultural meeting, and so they're 70% of the world's agricultural area. And when we also think about C3 grasses, these are the subfamily Poidae are often infected with a symbiont, an Epichloe species. And these species are utilised in agriculture already, but they're also common symbionts in many wild species. And I'm going to take you on a journey through some of the species that we've discovered in my presentation. But first of all, I want to talk about tall fescue, because the success of tall fescue has come about because of a dominant symbiont that is present part of the microbiome of tall fescue. And if we think about tall fescue and how it has been spread across the United States, and particularly the eastern side of the state, but sort of soon after it started being distributed, people did notice that there was poor animal performance. So although this crop could survive harsh environments and it seemed to really persist, the animal performance was declining and poor average daily gains. Animals were losing the tips of their ears, the switch of their tails and things. And it was attributed to a compound called ergovaline, but it took a while before ergovaline was found, and it took a while before it was recognised that ergovaline was being produced not by the plant, but by an endophyte within that plant. So, breeders, they know what to do and how to solve this problem, and it's very easy. You remove the endophyte from the plant, but when you do so and you have endophyte-free plots, the persistence isn't anywhere near as great as your endophyte-infected. So that wasn't a solution. The endophyte is clearly providing something to this host to help with greater persistence. Now, another solution was to look for non-ergot alkaloid producing endophytes. And people sometimes think it's easy to see that plants look different because they're clearly a structure that you can see. But when you're thinking about microbes, it's hard to imagine the diversity that there might be with microbes. But if you go to the centre of diversity for that particular species, in which case the tall fescue is out in Europe and in the Mediterranean area, you can actually find endophytes that don't produce that toxin ergovaline, but they are still providing some of the benefits. And then cultivars have been released, and I'm highlighting the Texoma Max Q2 cultivar that has come out of the Noble Research Institute in about 2012. Now, behind all of the scenes, there's also molecular biology became very popular and important, and we can do a lot of discovery with our molecular biology tools. So we've been able to identify the genes required for ergot alkaloid biosynthesis, and we're able to also generate draft genomes for the fungus itself. So what are these Epichloe species? We've got a symbiont that is present down in the crown region of the plant. It is ramifying in the plant, and it is growing with the plant. And I want to highlight that these are dominant fungi that are associated with the grass phytobiome. Okay, so this you can see how dominant it is here. It's the cyan blue labelled fungus. But more importantly, this endophyte is also associated and is able to grow up into the seed heads, where it is able to infect the developing seed, and then it gets transmitted through the seed. So this is a seed-transmitted symbiont as well, and that's really important. And that's how we've been able to develop cultivars, because we can have it through the seed line. Okay, so I've already mentioned that these Epichloe species, they're super symbionts, they're providing greater persistence, and I've highlighted the ergovaline, the problem with ergovaline, because these endophytes are able to produce bioactive alkaloids. It's not just ergovaline, we have the lolotrim B, which causes ryegrass staggers, and then there are also some compounds that are known for their anti-insect traits, the lolines and pyrimine here. So these bioactive compounds, if we think of them as in an ecological setting, they are a benefit to the host, and it's only when we think about them in an agricultural setting that we really wouldn't want to have ergovaline or lolotrim B present. But there are other traits that these endophytes seem to provide, and they're not all well understood, but drought tolerance, nutrient acquisition, pest and pathogen resistance, salinity tolerance, and the like. So I want to talk a little bit, and most of the presentation will be focused around the knowledge of the bioactive compounds, but how we can use these as a tool as well. And so we spent a lot of time, the researchers in the endophyte community, identifying the genes that are required for making these toxic compounds, and that some of these toxic compounds are compounds we want for anti-insect properties. And we know all the genes, which are represented by these arrows here, and we can translate that information into our knowledge of the pathways as well. So we can see the pathways that these the diversity of the pathways in terms of we can look for intermediates in these pathways and identify intermediates. We can also place the genes and where they encode for proteins and place them on there for their enzymatic capabilities in here as well. So we've also developed some genome resources, and this is a new and very exciting PacBio assembly of our favourite Epichloe species, which Epichloe festuci, which is a haploid species, and it's our model organism that we go to. And this has given us, this PacBio assembly has given us a chromosome assembly, which is really exciting. So 7 chromosomes, highlighting where we find the alkaloid biosynthesis genes. They're found at the telomere ends for ergovaline and lolotrim B, and more internally for pyrimine and the lolines. And although the lolines aren't present in this particular isolate, this is where you would find them in another species. And then we have around 48 draft genomes. It's counting every day, every week that goes by. It's likely the number increases. So we do have a large number of genetic resources that we can look at for multiple Epichloe species. Now, we can utilise this information to look more broadly across Epichloe and look. So here we've got a range of different Epichloe endophytes here and their associated tribe, their host tribes. And so just trying to show that they're diverse species and they're in a diverse array of hosts. And we can develop, or we have developed, a series of PCR primers that we utilise as markers to look to see for the presence of particular genes. So these are two markers for the PUR-A gene. This is for pyrimine biosynthesis. This is a first step in ergot alkaloid, first step in loline biosynthesis, and the first step in indole-diterpene biosynthesis. And these markers allow us to look closely at these isolates for their potential for their bioactivity that they may have. So we have a lot of questions. It's kind of that who, what, where and why of seed-transmitted symbionts. So how prevalent are these in the grass host? How diverse are they? Can we move them around? So we do know that these grass endophytes have a lot of host specificity, but can they be moved more broadly? Can we enhance some other crops with them, hence the wanting to move them? And what other traits can we mine? I just focused on the alkaloids, but are there other traits that we could identify? So this is how we've done our endophyte discovery. We have seeds or tillers here from the field. This could be a wild collection. I'm showing a sward plot here. We isolate DNA from these particular samples, and we have a high-throughput PCR screen, multiplex. We have a range of primers. There's around 20 markers that we run across these this material to look for diversity. And then we can, from that, we can predict what it's able to produce, whether it can produce these toxic compounds or whether it's producing something, maybe some natural variation within these biosynthetic pathways as well. And these haven't been dissective for their bioactivity, so we can look for what's being produced, and we need to look more at the impact of the production of these alkaloids. We can isolate and we can manipulate them. We can inoculate them back into their host. But also we use all of this information to help us build the phylogenies that are required. So we've got species identification of the Epichloe species. We relate this to their host associations. What's also interesting about these endophytes is they're not all haploid. Some of them are allopolyploids. And an example here is the endophyte out of Tall Fescue, which has a progenitor from the Epiconii, the Epichloe festuci, and the Epichloe subspecies Poe clade. So that some of these endophytes can be very, very complex. So for us, I'm more of a lab rat, and I don't do a lot of collections. So we needed to go to a place where we already had the data that was there for us. And so the idea was to go and mine the National Plant Germplasm System for species, for endophytes, essentially. So we're looking at the hosts, and we're requesting host species, and then looking and utilising the tools that I showed you before to see whether or not we have endophytes present there. So I thought it was interesting. It's like, wow, how many species do you have? So there's at least 15,000 species within this system. This isn't everything we've looked at, but I thought it highlighted a few lines in terms of agriculturally. So we've got tall fescue, meadow fescue, and an annual ryegrass, and then a couple of wild species here. And just the number of PI lines that we've looked at, and then the endophyte infection status that you can see. So ranging from really high, you know, around 78%, right down to about 12%. But you've got to keep in mind when we screened this, there was 1,500 samples. We only screened a single seed from each accession. So we're likely to be missing some of that that sort of infection level. But it's still, I thought 12% was pretty good, actually. So how does it work? So this is just showing you some examples with tall fescue, because there's some knowledge that we can gain here. So when we screen the line, so we utilise 6 seeds for each tall fescue PI line, and isolated DNA from them, and then did PCR. And so these are just highlighting the endophyte markers that we have. And so you can see in red boxes the ones that were endophyte free. You can see lines that had low endophyte infection levels. You can see lines that have high endophyte infection levels. But also you can see lines that have mixed infections. And what I didn't say earlier on is that a single plant is going to have a single Epichloe isolate associated with it. So how do we get mixed infections? And that's because when people go and do these collections, they're often not collecting seed from an individual plant, but they're collecting seed from this population of maybe 100 plants that are here, and within that population, not all of those endophyte-infected plants are the same endophyte, and that's the case that we have in these examples. We can take all of that information and broadly associate it with the alkaloids that each of these lines are able to produce. And from this, we can actually look at tall fescue, and we can associate one of 4 species, and only one of them's been named. These other three are nameless at the moment, but will hopefully have a name in the not too distant future. But we can associate genetic variation with them and group them, but we can tell each of them apart from each other as well. We were curious to know how that compared to SSR markers that have been developed. And so what I'm showing at the moment is from a paper from John Forrester's group out in Australia, who's looked at some of the same material as us. And they've used SSR markers, around 20 SSR markers. And while I like SSR markers, I don't find them very informative because it just shows me where they group. It doesn't tell me anything about the potential. But we went and associated what we knew based on the work that we've done, so you'll find that in this publication here. And what I'm going to highlight here is the difference between the Kentucky 31 endophyte that's broadly grouped within these clades here versus what I call profile 4, which are these endophytes that do not produce ergot alkaloids. And what a difference a strain can make. So this is what your Kentucky 31 does. It produces ergovaline. It's endophyte infected, and these animals have poor average daily gains, and they're really struggling and suffering from fescue toxicosis. Whereas something like MaxQ, it's still endophyte infected, but it's a different strain. It's not able to produce ergovaline, and these animals are looking nice and healthy. I don't have time to talk about the clone pair research that we're going to be doing, but what I do want to do is just highlight a poster that we have here at the meeting, poster 100. It'll be on Tuesday, and there's a couple of research associates that will be presenting that. Based on developing clone pairs of E plus and E minus plants, so you take an endophyte infected plant, you split it in half, you fungicide treat one half of that to kill off the endophyte, and then you can establish populations from endophyte infected and endophyte free populations. And we've developed seed from these populations, and so that we can evaluate them more under grazing and things like that, so that we can really see the difference between these two populations. And we're looking at this for the summer dormant tall fescue because we're not sure that with the dormant seed trait whether we need an endophyte associated with this tall fescue for survival. So I encourage you to go and see that poster. So moving on, just a couple of other ones that endophytes we've looked at meadow fescue. There's two endophytes that are known to be associated with meadow fescue, but this Epichloe uncinata is the most dominant one. But people are discussing, oh, I've got ergovaline production in my meadow fescue, and so we were curious about this. And once again, we went into that GRIN system and pulled out all of the PI lines for meadow fescue so that we could evaluate this material. And we screened 318 PI lines. There is an infection rate of 26%, so reasonable infection rate, and we identified four unique genotypes. But one of them was the dominant Epichloe uncinata that we expected. And I've got to prove this, but the remaining, I would say, are likely to be different hosts. They're likely to be tall fescue or perennial ryegrass. And we'll need to go back to those samples with markers that are more specific to those particular hosts so that we can determine that actually this is a misidentification of the host. We've done some work with native grasses, so Pyrrhosoides, a huge collection there, Alamus canadensis and Bromus levipes as well. And you can see there's various endophyte infection levels and everything. We'll skip through that one. And then there was another trait that we were interested in, which was Russian wheat aphid resistance. And that's been identified in some wild Hordeum species that have come from China. So we were curious to know whether the antibiosis was associated, or the reduction in chlorosis was associated with one of the known bioactive alkaloids. And we're still doing some work on that. But we've also tried to inoculate these into other host species. So we've got wheat, rye and barley. But what happens is when we take it out and put it into wheat, wheat and rye, in fact, we see that the plants are severely stunted. So there are some difficulties moving these endophytes into other host species. There's a lot of work being done with the ecology side of things as well, and we've managed to align ourselves with Jen Rudges, who's looked at things like whether undulates can have an impact on endophyte prevalence, and then looking at adaptability. And then looking beyond the Epichloe species, so grasses are great, but are there these types of endophytes in other host species? And I think that's a really important factor to look at. And we can see them, and they're well known. In fact, morning glories, so the Ipomoea, has a symbiont called periglandula. And it's known because it produces toxins, the ergot alkaloid toxins, and we've cloned the pathways for that. Likewise, loco weed, it has a symbiont associated with it that produces swainsonine, so it's known because it produces toxins. But what about other species? And so we've been working with Chris Shardle, and it was nice to meet Carol Baskins at the back of the room there, because she has a great collection at the University of Kentucky, and they've been sampling seeds and sending it to me. And we've developed a new set of, or we've actually screened all of the available fungal ITS primers to look just to see if can we identify other dominant endophyte species. These won't be epichloe species, other dominant endophyte species within the host. And we're going to be developing this for a NanoPure, the MinION platform, so that we get the longer reads and we can really do the identification of the putative endophyte in these species. So it was exciting to actually see that we had fungal-specific primers. So just in summary, seed-transmitted endophytes, they can be a dominant component of the host microbiome and definitely something you need to consider. If you are a grass breeder, that is really important, especially if you're working with something like tall fescue, perennial ryegrass, meadow fescue, or even annual ryegrass. The tools that we've developed really helps us to identify the prevalence of these endophytes in the cool season grasses, looking at the diversity of it. And we can also see diversity within a single host. So a single host species can have a greater diversity than what we had really realised before. And then we're applying these tools to help with other ecological questions and linking more broadly out into other host species as well. And I'm going to finish there. I'd like to acknowledge everybody that has helped me with this project. Some standouts would be Chris Shardle, and then also my lab members as well, or perhaps my lab members first and then Chris. And then I'm going to leave you with Phytobiomes because I want you all to publish there. And I'm happy to take any questions if I have time. It seems to be very much you have it or you don't, it seems to be very much that you have this endophyte infection or you don't. There are possibly levels of infection there, and we could go in and do some qPCR on it. We have done that sort of stuff before, but it does seem like yes or no, absolutely, yeah. Yeah? So how are we sure that there's only one type or one isolate of epichloe within a plant? And what we can do is we can actually inoculate a seedling and with a specific strain, and we know that that is the case, that endophyte will ramify throughout that plant. If you inoculate with two different strains, what happens is you get splitting out with the endophyte. One isolate will go out into some tillers and one will go out into the other. And so you can't maintain more than one isolate within a particular host and within a particular tiller. And also, there's no evidence from any marker. We can screen multiple tillers and we're always getting the same answers, so we don't see any other variation. Yeah?
So is there any fitness cause on both sides to have this epichloe when you don't have any stress?
So is there any fitness cost to have the epichloe when you don't have any stress? Yes, I think there is, but when you have stress, the benefit of having the endophyte way outweighs that. And so we've been looking with the clone pairs, and we've been looking, it's not so clear with the Mediterranean material as it is with the continental material, and Randy Dinkins in the back there, he does a lot of work with the continental material. We've been looking there, and what we've been finding is that under just standard growing conditions, when we have endophyte infected versus endophyte free plants, the endophyte infected are having, there's fewer tillers, but they're taller, and the endophyte free has got a lot more tillers, but they're shorter. And so that's just one example of the differences that we're seeing. It really surprised us, actually. I think we'd really have to dissect out a lot of the different traits, but yeah, you've got another microorganism there, so there will be some slight impact as well. Yeah?
Is there a quick test for farmers to test for risk?
Is there a quick test for farmers to test for Epichloe species? There actually is. There's a Agronostics has a an immunoblot test that's available. You can order it online, or you can send the samples out to Agronostics, the company based in Georgia that do it. If I know what's in a farmer's field and it's and they may have Texoma Max Q2, which is the cultivar that we released, and they're worried about maybe the effects that they've got, you know, that have they seeded that out correctly, I will test it for them because I want to see what's going on. But definitely the Agronostics kit is, you essentially are just sort of immunoblotting onto a nitrocellulose membrane with an antibody. Yeah, Maggie.
How faithful is the transmission of a single strain through seed? Like, does it ever happen or something else?
So how faithful is a single isolate doing in seed transmission, and can something else replace it? And there is a lot of talk about that when people are looking at replacing their toxic tall fescue cultivars with a non-toxic cultivar. So what we think is happening, it is a very closed cycle. Okay, that endophyte isn't in the soil and is waiting to take over another plant. So that is definitely not happening. Where you could get displacement is because you've got tall fescue Kentucky 31 toxic endophyte seed in the seed bank that still remains. So you haven't done due diligence when you're trying to replace your pastures, and you could also so that, yeah, basically just a replacement. We've been seeing some work, and Rebecca's got a really nice, Rebecca McCulley, the back there, has a really nice study where she's done planted lots of mixtures. And I think over the next few years we'll be able to see how quickly different endophytes may be more dominant over others in different environments. But it's a closed cycle, so no, any displacement is coming from the success of a plant within that that pool. Yeah?
One more question.
So when you think about microbiome or phytobiome, right, you're thinking about community.
Uh-huh.
So how did your experience fit into this community or systemic approach?
So how does this research fit into the phytobiome community? And I think that's a great question. I actually think that tall fescue represents the first decent phytobiome study that there is, because there are so many components. Here is one microbe that just the presence of that had an impact on plant productivity, and that plant productivity had an impact on grazing animals. And so all of the disciplines that had to come together to solve this as a how do we make a better product for farmers, I think it really represents an excellent phytobiome story, because there are so many different components to it, and I'm so glad you asked that question.
Good plan.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.